CFO Radio is the only radio show that explores the passion of the CFO and examines the innermost thoughts of the financial world, financial perspectives of tomorrow. Welcome to CFO Radio. I'm Lorraine Chilvers. Lee, if you would like to thank our sponsors.
Absolutely. Today's show is sponsored by Delaney Consulting LLC, providing financial leadership to fast-growing companies, interim management and executive placement for the finance function. Visit DelaneyLLC.com and learn why 100% of their clients describe Delaney services as outstanding and excellent. Also, the SAP Business by Design solution is a single integrated business management solution that delivers the best of SAP software on demand, offering the benefits of larger applications without the need for a costly IT infrastructure. And Financial Executives International, the preeminent association for CFOs and other financial executives. We are sponsored by the Atlanta chapter.
And this week's CFO Radio news comes to us from CFO.com. CFO Magazine has an article currently running that is along the lines of, I hate CFOs who always say no. This was an interview with Rose Macario, COO and CFO with Patagonia Inc. Clothing and gear manufacturer Patagonia has always relished the challenge of hard climb since its founding in 1975 by the legendary outdoorsman and environmentalist. The company has pursued a dual mission to make a profit, even as it uses business to inspire solutions to the environmental crisis, says Rose, the company's chief officer and CFO. Listening to this article, it's certainly very interesting. The positioning in terms of CFOs that often say no, we're very often thought as being negative people and not the funniest at the parties. Go check out CFO.com. Well, today we have with us Rebecca Isbell Flick. She is the former Vice President, Finance and Treasurer at Home Depot. Welcome to the show, Rebecca.
Thanks, Lorraine. It's great to be here with you today.
Well, I'm very excited to have you on the show. You've got a great background. Let me go through a little bit of it so that our listeners have a baseline of who and what you are and what you've been through. You have a Master of Business Administration with your major in Corporate Finance and a Bachelor of Science in Business Administration also. You are a member of T30, the Fortune 100 Treasurers Association, and you recently won some awards. Atlanta Woman of Excellence, and were a recipient of Home Depot's CEO Values Award. You started out your career with Continental Bank as a financial analyst and then grew through promotion to a corporate banking officer. And then you moved to Bank of America and became assistant vice president on the credit management side. Then you made a move through to a role where you were in treasury, obviously using that banking experience. And you've gone through not only having some roles in retirement and benefit plans, but core treasury, operational finance, and then also external relations. Very much a capital and a cash focus. I'm going to start off by maybe coining a phrase of our last guest, cash is king. Talk to us a little bit about that from your seat.
Well, I would say cash is king and queen, Lorraine. You know, you can't run a business on EPS or profits. You run it based on cash. And, you know, cash is a real proxy for shareholder value creation. And I think, you know, while we might have some sort of goodwill causes of our businesses, the primary goal is to create shareholder value. So I've always seen cash as a really good proxy for how well you're doing with that.
So tell us from the outset, you started in banking and you've obviously made a very successful jump into that of treasury. Just from the outset, somebody may be looking at your career and wanting to do a little bit of a mimic step. How does being on the inside of a bank and banking differ from the role of being corporate finance and that treasurer?
Well, I found the key difference in being on the other side of the table, so being a corporate treasurer versus a banker, as being the ability to actually implement the ideas that I had to add value and, you know, see the changes come to fruition. And that's very gratifying. I mean, as a banker, I loved calling on companies and helping them with their problems, issues, and opportunities. I mean, I'm a problem solver. That's sort of what turns me on is, you know, having a good challenge, a problem to solve. So I really always enjoyed helping my clients with that. But, you know, you didn't always see your recommendations be implemented. And sometimes that was a little, you know, disappointing. So when I came to Home Depot in, I guess, 1996, there were a lot of opportunities to add value. And, you know, my boss was very supportive of, you know, pursuing these opportunities. And so it just was a big kick going after the opportunities and making the changes and, you know, seeing the benefits.
Is there a particular project that you've had? I won't ask you specifically to name which company, but from a time in your career that jumps out as being, you know, this is something that I did and I'm really proud of.
Yeah, I think probably one of the things that I'm proudest of the most is, you know, what we built during the early part of this decade at Home Depot when Bob Nardelli was leading the company. It was quite a dramatic shift in our business strategy, having transitioned from being, you know, led by our founders, Bernie and Arthur, and having a business strategy of just growing by adding square footage. You know, Bob changed our business strategy quite dramatically, and it was one whereby we were pursuing sales growth by growing in areas adjacent to our core home improvement business. And, you know, Bob didn't look at the calendar. He looked at his watch. So, I mean, we moved really fast those days. And sort of the thing I love most about Home Depot is the spirit of the company. We really didn't have great resources, great systems, but we had a lot of people with a lot of spirit. And, you know, we just had the attitude that together we could get anything done. And so while Bob was at Home Depot, sort of end of 2000 to the beginning of 2007, we built Home Depot Supply, which ended up being nearly a $13 billion company. And it was through the acquisition of about 35 companies.
So did you oversee those acquisitions?
Oh, absolutely. So I was very intimately involved in the M&A process. I was responsible for finance integration activities. And so, you know, that was really important. It was a new area for me. And I am very grateful to my boss that she gave me the opportunity to be involved there because it was a great learning opportunity. And I really saw, you know, that being central to the actual value creation of acquiring these companies. I mean, the value doesn't come when you're penciling the deal or even closing the transaction. It comes when you start doing the heavy lifting afterward and, you know, integrating systems and streamlining processes and bringing the general ledgers together and, you know, a lot of heavy lifting. And so that was a really great opportunity. I'm proud of what we all did together during that time.
So 35 acquisitions in, you said, 7 years?
It was 7 years, but really most of those were done over the course of about 3 or 4 years.
So a couple of months.
Yeah, a lot. And I can remember one day when we closed 5 acquisitions on one day. So it was crazy. But, you know, we got it done. And again, just very gratifying to see what we could collectively do together and build together.
So how do you begin to integrate 5 companies that you close on the same day? Do you get all the mom and pops in a room and say the same message once and make sure they all hear it?
Yeah, well, I think it's a matter of, first of all, having really great people, you know, really smart people, and a breadth of people working on the integration teams, not just the people in finance integration that reported to me, but they had to build partnerships with folks at our store support center and at the company we acquired. And, you know, then it was more a matter of influence. It's not a matter of who reports to who, but you know, you have to be able to get people to work with you. And so the team was just great, you know. They built great relationships that were smart. They had great tools. We built standard integration checklists, you know. So, you know, we knew exactly where we needed to look and what we needed to do, and it was very regimented that way.
Now, in that regard, a company the size of Home Depot, certainly from my experience in the Fortune 500, very often what happens is that the integration team may be part of initially some of that due diligence. You may not be the force totally behind it, but were you involved, and to what extent did you have lessons learned there that you bled into the integration?
Oh, yes. We had a lot of lessons learned. And, you know, I think it's just impossible to not make any mistakes. And I think if you don't make any mistakes, you're not taking risk, enough risk. And, you know, the important thing is that you've got to learn from your mistakes. And so we were also very regimented about debriefing afterward and on an ongoing basis. We had monthly integration meetings with the CEO, with Bob, you know, and so we debriefed on the lessons learned, how well we were doing integrating, were we on track, you know, the value, the cost, and all of this relative to our assumptions in the acquisition pro forma. So, you know, I think we had a lot of good processes that helped us manage this all very effectively.
Now, let me ask you a question of the CIO role in the information systems. Obviously, with you leading the integration for these companies, we've got a lot of focus that we've had in terms of the human capital and the personnel side of it. Clearly, there has to be an operation on the operations. There has to be a focus on the operations and process. Talk to us a little bit about how you integrate the process and how you integrate the systems.
Well, yeah, so obviously the integration team included representatives from the IT department. They had a lot of knowledge and expertise around different kinds of accounting systems, merchandise systems, et cetera. And so, you know, we knew early on in evaluating the opportunity, what the system's implications would be, whether they would be easy to integrate, whether or not we would need to completely swap out the company's general ledger system or other systems. So, you know, there was a heavy, heavy emphasis on IT and heavy involvement by the IT department.
Did you take an approach of thou shalt use our system, or was it on a look-and-see individual basis?
It really was look and see on an individual basis, and I think still today, HD Supply is a separate company because we sold it in 2007. But I think even today, it's not a state of nirvana like everybody is on the same system. There are still, you know, various different systems, and sometimes that has to do more with what the underlying business is, you know, and the mothership system maybe was not always the best operating solution for the business. So I think that we did try to balance the trade-offs between having standardization of systems and, you know, having the flexibility to support the local business needs.
Well, that being said, what is the biggest challenge that you would say in terms of that integration? You talked a little bit about you think that the big game is really trying to determine and going through penciling the deal, I think you said, but that the challenge really comes after. What would you say is the number one challenge?
Well, I think the challenge is just the human resources, you know, having the time and talent to get to everything, because daily folks had other opportunities, whatever their normal ongoing business responsibilities were, and the integration responsibilities were sort of incremental to that. So, you know, really having
so take the 40-hour week and double it?
Yeah, sort of that was it. And so people just worked really hard. You know, we did have some people dedicated to integration, but for the most part, it was just, you know, normal daily folks who also had their day job also doing the integration work on top of that. And so
lots of pizza parties, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. Lots of pizza parties. We took a lot of opportunities to celebrate the successes. And again, it's just based, a lot of it was based on just the sheer will and spirit of the folks, you know, working on our teams.
And some good checklists.
Absolutely.
You know, it's funny you mentioned that. In finance, we tend to follow lives of checklists, and the SEC is getting more and more in our boots, so to speak. Sarbanes-Oxley has certainly made sure that we even lift up the corner of the covers of the Excel spreadsheet. How do you balance the need of what you have to have of the regimen of, let's say, a checklist or the regimen of we've got to have standardization with the balance of, but we bought them because they're good at what they do. Thereby, if we go in and change them, are they still going to be as effective, efficient, and profitable?
Right. And that was certainly a big consideration for a long time after we got scale with HD Supply. Some of the businesses we acquired did continue to operate under their original name, and that is often important because, you know, a lot of the customer relationships are based on that name and the history and the goodwill built up. Eventually, I believe that all the storefronts did change their names to HD Supply, but it was a real long, gradual process with a big focus on maintaining those customer relationships. So definitely it is a balance between reaping the efficiencies of standardization and also, you know, keeping intact some of the, you know, value that was created in the underlying business.
Does that give you any rise for next time around you'd do it differently?
I don't think so. You know, that was just such a great learning opportunity and experience for me, being so heavily involved in that, the M&A, that I really can't think of anything that we could have done better or differently. We had the process down. We had great people and, you know, great checklist and the right framework, how to look at all this. And, you know, there was a commitment all the way up to the chairman and CEO to do this right. Mm-hmm. And so I can't think of what we would do better.
Well, let me ask you a couple of questions about some of that hardcore corporate finance. Let's face it, it's all about the numbers. If the numbers don't come through, then a company's got pretty tough decisions to make. You've had quite significant roles in terms of corporate finance, and you've also been on the external relations side. So you've been that party to be that, if you will, connection with the outside community, the world at large. Talk to us a little bit about the role of corporate finance. Ahead of the acquisition, you're trying to figure out what the numbers are. You're trying to figure out the value, the deal that's going to be signed, and the perspective. What is that role after the deal? Does corporate finance just move on to the next gig?
Well, I think that, you know, corporate finance decisions are made every day in a company, and hopefully there's still a focus after a company is acquired and integrated on making decisions that impact shareholder value and about how we raise capital and deploy capital. After we acquired these companies, I continued to stay involved with them from a capital allocation perspective. I became responsible for our CapEx budget company-wide. And again, I'm so grateful that my boss, you know, these are sort of non-traditional treasury activities. I really grew far, far out of the treasury role. And so I'm grateful that, you know, she allowed me to be so involved in that, because it was a great way to get involved in all the areas of our company. But just from the point of shareholder value, you know, these are daily decisions about how you raise capital and how you deploy capital. And, you know, they have big impacts on the value that you're creating. And so as it pertains to the acquisitions, I was grateful to be able to stay involved with them and, you know, help them allocate their capital as well to make sure we continue to generate value with those businesses.
Well, you mentioned something there in terms of not only the value, but that outward-facing view. One of our previous guests was the lead for investor relations at Winn-Dixie. Let me ask you to go a little bit, if I can, for that external relations. What was your role? Was it to investors? Was it to bankers? Was it to customers? Was it to government entities? What was your role there in terms of coordination with external relations?
Well, I was directly responsible for the relationships with our bankers, our rating agencies, and our fixed income investors. So that was ongoing. And from time to time, our investor relations had included me in equity analyst conversations as well, which was fine. And so you just have to always remember, you know, sort of which hat you're wearing. Conversation changes a little, but I really enjoyed that part of my job.
Well, what I'd like to do is to talk a little bit about the operational finance as well. You had led at one point an in-store conversion, and I think Home Depot is actually an SAP user of software. Being that it is very much a customer-facing organization, you're very directly, the customer's right there. They're buying, whether it's a plant or some wood or nails and screws, the customer's right there. So perhaps we can delve a little bit into the operational finance and that in-store conversion. Talk a little bit about that, if you would.
Well, I think you're probably referring to our conversion at the POS to electronic check conversion. And again, that was a big team effort. It was, you know, impossible to do anything at Home Depot alone. I mean, you really did need, you know, large cross-functional teams. But that also was a lot of fun because we saw shareholder value trapped in our cash conversion cycle. And part of that is how long it takes to get money once people pay for it, the merchandise at the register into our bank account. And
that's through the credit card processing, or is that with
credit cards, checks, cash, getting the cash to the banks and then to our concentration bank. So it's all forms of tender because we don't get immediate availability for any form of tender, and they all have various different floats associated with them. But on a company the scale of Home Depot, you know, nearly $70 billion company, 2,200 stores worldwide, that value, even if it's just a day or two, is a lot of money. It's millions of dollars. And so we saw that as another opportunity, you know, to release shareholder value. And so that was a lot of fun working with a cross-functional team to implement.
So that's fun. Now you're talking about efficiencies. You're not the hardcore the CFO that says no, as in the news article that we had, but now you're the CFO saying, okay, the answer is yes. How do we do it?
Yeah, absolutely. I really always hated for people to say no to, and no is just too easy to say. But it's not, you know, if not yes, then how can we do it? And so again, and they all represented, you know, opportunities to solve problems and issues. So we always loved a good challenge at Home Depot.
Well, that being said, solving problems and taking what is an issue and creating that into a success, we are coming to the end of our show, and I'd like to ask you a question that we ask all of our guests. We've got a tradition on the show to ask our guests, what is your CFO tip of the month? What's yours?
Yeah, I think it is, don't wait for the markets to rebound to start thinking about investing in growth. You know, everybody's been so inwardly focused over the last couple of years, focused on reducing cost and freeing up cash and capital, just sort of in a survival mode, very risk averse. And it's hard to transition that mindset from one of protection and survival to one of, you know, innovation and growth. And so the markets are still very attractive. Multiples are still relatively cheap. Capital is still relatively cheap. Interest rates are low. And so, you know, I think if companies don't think now about how to invest for the future, they could miss a great opportunity.
So go buy that house.
Yes, absolutely. Great example.
Go enable your employees to go buy another house.
Absolutely. The housing market really needs that.
Who was it that said money makes the market go round?
I'm not sure, but I like that.
Well, Rebecca, this has been a pleasure. We'd like to formally thank you for being on our show. Thanks to Rebecca Flick for sharing your innermost thoughts on the role of the CFO.
No, thank you for having me. It's been my pleasure.
And we would like to thank our contributors to CFO Magazine, CFO.com, for more information on that very exciting article. Thanks to our sponsors, Delaney Consulting, providing CFOs and controllers to Fortune 1000 companies and fast-growing businesses alike. For more information about Delaney, please go to www.delaneyllc.com. Thanks also to SAP Business by Design, the software as a service business management solution for small to medium-sized companies. For more information, go to www.sap.com/SME. And finally, thanks also to Financial Executives International. They can be found on the web at financialexecutives.org. This and other thought leadership from today's CFO is available right from your computer at cforadio.com. If you are a CFO or would know of a CFO that would like to be a guest on the show, please contact us via the web. Thank you for listening to CFO Radio. This is Lorraine Chilvers signing off. Until next time.